probably by revolutionary peasants rather than foreign enemies, although a great deal of warfare broke out towards the end too. And there's one site where they actually have found barricades put up with stones that have been torn from the fronts of the temples to make a stockade for a kind of last stand. So clearly there was massive social unrest, probably a combination of warfare and revolution. Not only the rulers had lost prestige, but the people were angry at them, and the gods seemed to have lost prestige since they were tearing down the temples in a desperation to keep out whoever their enemies were. However, I don't want to overemphasize the collapse of the civilization, because what essentially happened was it was a temporary setback. It was a collapse of a power structure, and certainly a lot of people lost their lives, and some parts of the Maya region became depopulated and the jungle grew back, Tikal being the prime example. But the Maya civilization didn't end. It carried on in Highland Guatemala, carried on in Yucatan, and there are still millions of Mayas around today who still speak their language and retain many elements of their culture, including the use of the ancient ritual calendar and so forth. So the Mayas aren't gone. Well, they weren't erased from the earth by their folly, but clearly a civilization at a height of power and at a time when a great deal of power was concentrated into very few hands, that went through a very unpleasant collapse. It took, 100, 150 years for these classic cities to fall silent one after another.
You mentioned in your talk that as the old world starts investigating the new world, they come over on their ships and they find these ancient Mayan civilizations and they find these people that are living there. They're hit by this terrible, terrible disease. Smallpox just ravages the populations, just wipes out half the population in the first wave. So I was wondering, why is it that disease went from the old world to the new world and not the opposite way? Why did not the new world infect the old world with some disease?
That's a very good question, and epidemiologists are still looking into that. There is one disease that seems to have gone the other way, and that is syphilis. But syphilis, even though when it first showed up in Europe in the late 1490s, was a very severe illness, much more severe than it is now. It was not a mass killer on a par with smallpox, so it did not have the same social impact. And nor was Europe being invaded by nightmarish outsiders at the same time. But the smallpox was a mass killer and is a mass killer if it ever gets out again. It still does exist in a few labs around the world. And one theory that I've heard that sounds plausible, but I'm not an expert, I'm not a medical expert, is that a lot of the diseases of the old world developed because people were living in close proximity with domestic animals such as pigs and chickens. And the New World had some domestic animals, but not pigs. And think of swine flu. That's one that definitely cycles through pigs and humans. And, of course, these diseases evolve and change over time, so it's hard to document where they came from. But there seemed to have been the Old World being bigger and having some very concentrated populations, particularly in Asia. A lot of the mass plagues, including the Black Death that hit Europe in the 14th century, seem to have originated in Asian cities, which are, warm tropical environments, great place for diseases to thrive, people living very densely packed and living with animals, often in the same houses or with the animals downstairs, people upstairs, that kind of arrangement. You didn't have that kind of living arrangement in the New World, and you had far fewer domestic animals. So that's one theory. But, I don't think anyone can say for sure why that was. It was just very bad luck on the New World and good luck for the Old World that the worst thing they got was syphilis.
The power of film, the power of taking the ideas from your book, A Short History of Progress, and from your Massey lectures and putting them into a film like Surviving Progress, the power of that is that it can get big ideas out into the open and openly discussed. And I'm wondering if you think that there's a way to have widespread discussions about the fate of human industrial civilization, about our potential and our pathway towards collapse right now, or are these ideas taboo?
A little while ago, they were taboo. They were considered to be the realm of cranks. But, people have been warning about this stuff for a long time. And one of the things I mentioned in Short History of Progress was, these Victorian writers who we think of as kind of early science fiction writers, people like H.G. Wells, and then in the early 20th century, Aldous Huxley. In the mid-century, George Orwell, writing nightmare futures, saying, look, this is the kind of thing that might happen if we're not careful. So people have been warning about it for quite a long time, ever since technological progress started to run away so that people actually felt it in the course of their own lives. the speed of change being great enough to actually detect it in the human life, which is fairly short after all. Ever since that time, people have worried about it, but many of these people were dismissed as cranks or as just being hyperbolic and so forth. But I think that the climate of opinion is really changing. We've seen many books and films that have reached a wide audience. I mean, An Inconvenient Truth is one, The Corporation is another, and I think many people now realize, partly because the pace of change is speeding up all the time and because the world really has been overrun by people and their machines, more and more people are realizing that this is not going to end well unless we take charge of it and sort of say, we have to slow this down and we have to think where it's going and we have to come up with a way of managing it. And I think that's going to have to be done. It's a discussion that should be held worldwide and can only really be solved on a worldwide basis. I mean, we can do things locally that are really good things. We can, recycle our garbage and we can compost and we can grow food, those who have a place to grow it and so forth. Locally, these efforts are valuable and we can do those. And I think people are doing that, and that is helping to change attitudes. But also, we need a level playing field economically and legally at the international level so that a company can't go to some country where there's the cheapest sweatshop labor or the most polluted river and nobody cares. The regulations governing what you can do to the environment and what you can do to other human beings have to be the same everywhere. And I think that would, when we achieve that, this is something certainly the United Nations and the European Union and other world bodies are trying to do. But when that is achieved, then we will see many of the worst aspects of globalization tend to mitigate, because people won't be able to get away with stuff like that. And there won't also be these sort of horrendously cheap labor countries where you can turn out tons of shoddy goods, sort of making things that last and things that are well-crafted by people who get well-paid.
I kind of wanted to focus for a second on the Massey lecture itself. Those lectures go on in Canada, in a country that's very much like the United States, that has, same kind of demographics, similar population density in the major cities. The conversations that are going on surrounding those kind of lectures are very, very different than the kind of conversations that happen in the United States. Do you see a fundamental difference between the attitudes in the two countries?
Well, I think that, you're right to say we share a lot of things in common, but there are some deep cultural differences. And I explored this in a later book, What is America?, where I was trying to understand why the United States actually is outside the mainstream of Western civilization these days. It's a place of very old-fashioned, rigid thinking. It's the only Western nation which has this incredibly devout population, where something like half the population think the world was created more or less as described in Genesis. You just don't find that in other Western countries. So it is an anomaly. The United States is an anomaly. It happens to be such a big country that we tend to be influenced by this much more than we should. I see it as a rather archaic white settler state, and one reason for its peculiar culture is because it broke away from the mother country much earlier. And a great deal of the American cultural attitudes were forged on the frontier in that sort of rolling war zone that rolled across the North American continent for two or three centuries from east until it hit the west. And that sort of xenophobia, that religious fanaticism, and that militarism are all characteristics of the frontier cultures. And I think, some very influential American historians have argued this and would agree with this. Whereas Canada stayed hooked into the European powers longer. And I think in Canada we have a social democracy that is closer, or at least until the present government took power, was closer to that of the European countries and of Britain than to the American system. We don't have that national myth of endless plenty, of just taking whatever we need and dismissing the interests of the rest of the world as being either irrelevant or a threat to our national autonomy. I mean, you have American leaders saying, well, we can't sign onto an emissions agreement about carbon dioxide because that's a threat to the American way of life. Ronald Reagan said the same thing when the law of the sea first came along, during his tenure as president. He refused to sign it because it was a threat to American sovereignty. And that particular kind of go-it-alone xenophobia and hostility and dismissal of the rest of the world is something that is pretty unique to the United States, although it does creep up here, and it has crept into Britain. I mean, during Margaret Thatcher's tenure, and it's creeping up here. While we have a small group of right wing extremists who've managed to take control of the political system.
Yeah, and introducing many of the same, or trying to introduce many of the very ominous aspects of the United States, and trying to introduce them up here as well.
By introducing extremist right wing Tea Party like values, and also it's now becoming increasingly clear using particularly American types of electoral fraud.
Exactly. I wanted to ask about our love affair with science, because science and the materialistic values that we've been holding on to have given access to many unbelievable things to a lot of people in the developed world and even the developing world. And many people there are aspiring to have the things that we have, like iPhones and the unbelievable amounts of goods that we can purchase cheaply relative to their ecological costs. And I'm wondering if there's a way to end our love affair with science while not reverting back to the dark ages. And if there is such a thing as rehab for technology addiction, what would that look like?
Well, I hope so. I'm not against civilization, and I'm not against appropriate technology applied in a wise and socially and environmentally responsible way. Many of us would not be here if we didn't have modern medical science, and that's the good side of that technology. The bad side is that modern medical science has allowed us, our population, to mushroom from 1 billion less than two centuries ago to 7 billion now, and that, you know, is a large part of our problem. If you're going to introduce death control in the form of high-tech medicine, then you have to introduce birth control. We know that now, but it's kind of got away from us. We didn't, even though we've known that for quite a long time, because of various social, religious, and political problems or difficulties, you know, we haven't done nearly as much with birth control as we should have done, especially while it was more manageable, although some countries have. I mean, Thailand has, Iran has, China, of course, has. You know, so it's not something that can't be done. It's not something hopeless. So I think we've got enough technology. I mean, the Astronomer Royal of Great Britain, Sir Martin Rees, in his book about the risks of technology, says, you know, we don't need more technology. We don't need new technologies to solve our problems. We simply need to use the ones we have properly. You know, I just gave the example of how medicine could be used in a better way, and the same is true of almost everything. What we don't need, though, is so many of these gadgets. I mean, these gadgets are eating up our time. They are produced by people in horrendous conditions in sweatshops in countries where decent social conditions are just not there. And really, what do they do for us? You know, I mean, we've all got, just like Sir Martin Rees saying, we've got all the technology we need. We've got all the gadgets we need. I mean, you know, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, just having a telephone and a radio was enough. And I mean, I didn't even own television until the 1980s, and I never missed it, and actually hardly watch it now either. But I do use a computer. You know, I find a computer very useful. It's a great writing tool. However, I do not leave it switched on all the time and spend all my time surfing the net. You know, every technology we have is two-edged. And I guess we need to develop human values that enable us to master our machines instead of letting them master us.
And again, I'm truncating that slightly. If you want to hear the full podcast from which I took that interview, you can do so from extraenvironmentalist.com. And now we're going to hear about the underground forests of Niger, about, if you can call it that, the technology of FMNR, farmer-managed natural regeneration, which, quite apart from regreening the desert, offers me a potent symbol of what we could do, what humanity could achieve without any number of new complex, advanced or large-scale practices, just by sharing the knowledge and working with nature for a change and not against it. And to watch this presentation, you can download the video from our webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/633. It was given at the 10th International Permaculture Conference, September 2011, in Amman, Jordan.
I hope that you're encouraged by the story that I'm going to share today. It's a story about a regreening movement and the history behind the development of farmer-managed natural regeneration. So it's a regreening movement that doesn't involve actual tree planting. And I hope that you're inspired and that some of you will even start your own movement and capture some of the vision that I have for this activity. I started this work off over 30 years ago in Niger Republic, West Africa, when I took my very young family back then to this country on the edge of the Sahara Desert. And I think for the first 6 months, as a young agricultural graduate, I was in a state of shock. This guy here, he's not standing in the middle of the Sahara Desert. That's his farm. It's the second year in a row that he's had a total crop failure. And in that particular year, he'd already planted his crop 3 times. And I was a little bit worried about my friend because he was wandering off on his own. You can see the way his shoulders are quite slumped. And he was starting to talk to himself. And I think he was very, very worried. How am I going to feed my 15 children? As you would be. And I was just totally overpowered by what confronted me. Here I was supposedly the resident expert, and I came into contact with a landscape very, very degraded, rapid desertification occurring, wind speeds of over 70 kilometres per hour at planting time, soil surface temperatures exceeding 60 degrees Celsius. So a very, very hostile environment for trying to grow a crop in. There are a whole range of different insect and disease problems that people were facing. The main food crop is millet, the staple diet of the people. And in any year, you could get this great range of species of insect problems. And just as an extreme example, 1988, we had a dry start to the year. The rains were late in coming. And so people were late in planting their crops. And when you've only got a 4-month window of the rainy season, it's very, very important. And for every day later, potentially it's reducing the yield of that crop. So that they started late, then we had windstorms. And every time they replanted their crop, the windstorms would come and bury it again. And some farmers replanted their seeds 5, 6, even 8 times. And we're not talking about some infinite pool of seed that they have. It's actually their grain store. And what they plant means that much less for eating. And even in a so-called good year, people rarely grew enough food to see them through for the whole year. So they continued to plant, and some of the crops started to come up. And then that year we had a plague of locusts. Still in the nymph stage, they covered the land like a fine mat. And any little millet plant that stuck its head through the surface got mown off. We had crows that could see where the drill holes were, where the seed was planted, and they'd go and scratch up the seed and eat it, and we had a rat plague. Some crops miraculously got past all that, and then we had stem borers, these little caterpillars, and as the millet was growing, they burrow into the stem and eat their way up through the stem, reducing its ability to draw up water and nutrients. Anything that got past that was then attacked by head borers. So another type of caterpillar that specializes in eating the grain. They actually waste more than what they eat because they crawl up under the grain of the millet head, and they push out more than they actually consume. But at the end of the day, it didn't matter anyway because the rain stopped early that year and nothing reached maturity and people harvested absolutely nothing. So that was quite an extreme year, but it just gives you a little micro picture of what the conditions were like. And in any year, you could have any single one of those problems or any combination of them, or as in this case, all of them altogether. In normal years, we have an 8-month dry season in Niger, and the rainfall, when it does come, is very variable. It can range from 150 millimetres in very good years up to 500 millimetres, but sometimes almost no rain at all. And so drought was a very frequent occurrence. Even in the good years, there was a great shortage of fodder, and so very high mortality rates and morbidity rates. And very often, cows that gave calf or the sheep lambing wouldn't have enough milk for the offspring because they were just too malnourished. And so this had a great impact on human nutrition, on income generation, but even in terms of agriculture, the manure from these livestock, it was critical for getting good yields in that very, very infertile soil. And so there were all these flow-on effects. And so every year there are food shortages. And during our period there, we were involved in famine relief during 5 separate years. And it was a very, very difficult time, not just for the people, but for us involved in trying to do food relief and organise Food for Work programs. And that famine experience, particularly the first one, 1984, which was a particularly harsh famine, had a very big impact on my life, and it shaped my determination to try to address the root causes, try to get to the bottom of what's bringing all this about. At that stage, I was managing the Maradi Windbreak and Woodlut project, and in summary, it was probably a total failure. We were planting around 4,000 trees per year, but the odds were stacked against us. Even right from the nursery phase of the project, everything that could go wrong usually did. And so we had the people were drawing water from wells that were 40 to 60 metres deep in 40 degree temperatures under very harsh conditions. You had to build a fence, and we wouldn't supply materials that weren't obtainable at the local level, so people had to make thorn fences to keep the goats out. Because it was the only green patch in a wide area of just barren land, it attracted birds, lizards, even frogs. I don't know where they came from. And they would burrow and dig and upset the young germinating seeds and cause very high losses. One year, I don't know why, but one year we even had termites come up and they ate the polythene bag, so that when you lifted the tree to plant it, all the soil fell off and it reduced the tree's likelihood of surviving. The trees in that photo, they've survived the first year or so, but they're still subject to browsing by goats and camels. And so all the way through, it was just an uphill battle. And very often, what I was doing seemed to be as useless as trying to sweep back the sands of the Sahara with a hand broom and shovel. And I wondered to myself, you know, how many years would it take to make an impact? How many million dollars? How many staff? And I really felt I was just wasting my time. And I wasn't alone. I discovered years later that NGOs and the government of Niger over a 20-year period had spent millions of dollars and planted 60 million trees. But if you go there today, very few of them are visible. They just didn't survive. So I wasn't the only crazy guy out there trying to do something. But in that discouragement, I was ready to give up, ready to go home. It was just all too hard. But the solution came to me, and for me personally, as an answer to a very simple prayer. We've wrecked the environment, the beautiful creation that you've given us. Now people are suffering. Please help us, show us what to do. And for the first time, even though at that stage I'd been there 3 years, driving through this country almost daily, certainly weekly, year after year for those 3 years, for the first time I saw what had been there all along. I'd seen it without seeing. And if you look in the background there, all these little clumps of green just look like desert grasses or perhaps shrubs. They're actually the tree stumps of what I call an underground forest. And in reality, there are millions of trees still in many of these degraded landscapes, just waiting for a chance to be cared for and to grow back to maturity. But often, for whatever reason, often we're blind to what's right there at our feet. And it's quite amusing now when I have the opportunity to run workshops on this regeneration method, and often you'll travel halfway around the world to tell this story and people are just shaking their head. This guy got paid to get in a plane, come all the way here to tell us what's at our feet. It's quite amusing. But that very simple discovery, which isn't unique to me, in other areas of the world it's called assisted natural regeneration. Historically in English we call it coppicing or politing. So it's not some great discovery, but for me it was a real revelation. And it was also the turning point of everything that we did in that work. And with it came the realization we were not fighting the Sahara Desert. You know, you have these grand schemes, these green belts, these great plans to plant trees and stop this great wall of sand coming down from the north. We weren't fighting the Sahara at all. We were fighting attitudes and beliefs and practices on how land is managed. And we were fighting misguided government policies, policies that were made in good intent to protect the vegetation, but in effect, which are working in the opposite way. So the policies in general were that the government owned the trees, and the people who depended on them for their livelihoods weren't allowed to touch them. And of course, if it's not yours and it's not mine, if you don't take it, somebody else will. So what belongs to the government must belong to everybody. And the net result of that was that practically all the trees in that landscape, the southern one-third of Niger Republic, disappeared over a period of 30 to 50 years. And so the more you get involved with this, you start to see trees everywhere. What seem to be barren, naked landscapes, when you actually get out of the car and walk through the fields and sometimes have to get down on your hands and knees to look for them, very often there's a tree stump there that's trying to re-sprout, or a seed that a bird's dropped or a goat's dropped in its manure that's sprouting, but it hasn't got a chance without a little bit of assistance. Maybe it requires a change of practice so that people don't burn indiscriminately. Maybe it requires just to open people's eyes so that when they're ploughing, they don't plough all this regrowth under. But the more I look, and I've had the great privilege of travelling to many, many countries through my current role in World Vision, the more I see the potential for this approach to reforestation. I don't think it's that most people haven't seen the trees there. I think it's more an issue that they don't have any ownership over those trees, and there's no real benefit for individuals to protect them. And so people just, it's much easier to stick with what the convention is and not create trouble with the normal practice of the culture and do what everybody else does. There's an added complication. A lot of people believe that having trees in your cropland will reduce yields. And often under some species, you can see from heavy shading or the particular competition that species gives to a crop. It's true with some species, but I'll demonstrate in the slides that are coming, by and large, with the right type of pruning and the right species in the fields, crop yields will not only double, in some cases they triple because of the presence of the trees. So just a very simple definition, what is farm-managed natural regeneration? Systematic regeneration of trees from living tree stumps, roots and seeds. And again, it's not complicated. When I do the workshops, I have a $2 pocket knife and basically describe what you can see on the screen there. You start off with a tree stump that's got multiple stems. Because the main trunk has been cut, its whole capacity is poured into regrowing, but it's got no discrimination. It's pushing up 20, 30, sometimes even 50 stems. Well, it's like having a big family. If you have too many children, it's very, very hard to feed all of them. And all we teach the farmers is pick the tallest and the straightest stems, cut out the rest, and then within the ones that you've picked, prune off the bottom half or the bottom third of side branches so that you can guide that growth. Another false belief that was working against indigenous species in Niger, at least, was professional foresters felt, indigenous species grow crookedly, they grow slowly, they're not much use. And so they favoured eucalyptus and trees from India, the neem tree, because there was the appearance that they grew fast. But with these trees, if you prune them, because they already have a mature root system, very hard to beat that growth rate. And with the pruning, they will grow straight. And even if they didn't, it doesn't matter, because the traditional uses for firewood and local construction didn't require millable timber. And so from the very first year, we start to see a difference. Not one of those trees in the foreground was planted. It's all natural regeneration from the tree stumps that were there but hadn't been seen for over a generation. And if you look closely, there's another difference in that slide. Whereas before, because there was no firewood and the women were walking for hours to get the firewood, they were using all the crop residues for cooking. Now, because of the prunings of the trees, even though it's fairly, in our minds, fairly insignificant, what prunings could you get from that? But it was enough to make a difference so that people started mulching. And so we started to see improvement in the soils, in water retention, reduced evaporation, and eventually in crop yields. By the second to the fourth year, the place is unrecognisable. And again, without planting a single tree. Some of the hardest people I have in convincing about this method are professionals. And so here's this really cheap method. You can do it with a $2 pocket knife, very rapid. And yet the establishment, in a way, has been spending millions of dollars trying to solve the problem of desertification, trying to regreen these semi-arid areas. And you're trying to tell me that you can do it with a pocket knife and a group of people who are mostly uneducated? And I say, yes, yes, you can, and that's all it takes. And people have gone a bit overboard in Niger. I worry sometimes because back then we very, very timidly said to them, oh, perhaps leave 20 trees per hectare or perhaps 40 at the most, but no more than that. We're really worried about your your crop yields. But they themselves have experimented and adapted. They've seen what works. They've seen which species are fertilizer trees and which ones are too competitive with their crops. Some of these farmers are leaving 100, 150 trees per hectare in their farmland, in their cropland. In 2004, there was a very severe famine in Niger. The people who were practicing this didn't require food aid. They still had the same problems that others had with the drought and the locust plague, but because of the protection of their trees, they did get some yield from their millet crops. But in addition to that small yield, they had firewood and building poles to either use themselves or to sell, and with the income buy extra food. They had fodder from the tree seeds, the pods, and in some cases the leaves, so their livestock didn't starve, so they had milk and meat, and sometimes animals to sell. They had wild fruits, medicines, and the works. So the people practicing this didn't require famine relief that year. I don't think I did a very good job at creating environmentalists. These people are living on the edge. They need to survive. And for me, in trying to analyse, well, what's happened here? Why have they taken this on to such a large degree? They're able to make money from the trees. It's very easy to be puritanical and yes, I do love the environment and there is a place for protection, protected areas. But in working with people that are regularly facing starvation, you have to be realistic. And in this case, a large part of the driver, apart from the increased crop yields and the other benefits, but a large part of the driver, I believe, was their ability to sell that wood legally on the open market and bring in an income. People with a little bit more energy and innovation, value added the product. So you get a very small amount of money for firewood, but people started to build build tools, furniture, hut roofs. So they value added to it and got more money per unit of wood. And just with the children there, so that's just the first year. Very small amount of wood, but even that, for people who are walking so far to get the firewood, relying on the crop residues, and in some cases I witnessed people even using not cow manure but goat pellets as their chief fuel for cooking with. Even that, I don't despise it. It made a big difference in the first year. But the good thing was that year after year as those trees grew, people not only met their own firewood needs, they had a surplus to sell. And in an area where people used to walk 20 kilometres, if they had a special occasion and they needed extra firewood, or if they were going to build a hut and they needed building timber, they'd walk to the main city to buy imported wood from the neighbouring country, Nigeria. Today, they have two wood markets a week in some of these villages, and the city people come out in their Land Rovers to buy the wood from the farmers. And I think that's the way it should be. And so farmers started to develop their own strategies. On the left there, they've got a bit of a rotation system going. So the main trunk has sprouted a number of shoots. You can see the main one there and then a number of smaller ones coming on. They'll harvest the largest one perhaps this year to meet their needs this year, but they're continuously grooming new ones to be ready for harvest in the coming years. The farmer on the right, he's decided, no, it's better to keep a tree with the main trunk and just harvest a few branches per year, perhaps a third, so he has a three-year rotation, but he never completely destroys that tree. I think another secret of the spread of this method of regeneration is that we didn't put restrictions on people. You know, I would have loved to have set rules and regulations and this is how you do it and don't you stray from it. But we gave people the freedom to choose for themselves what suits their needs. What market conditions are you looking to meet? What crop are you looking to grow? What species do you need in that space? And left it up to them. And I think that freedom gave people a lot of confidence to experiment, to talk to their neighbours, and to work it out for themselves. And so the big turnaround from being people continuously plagued by famine and poverty, they're certainly not rich, they're not driving around Mercedes-Benz, but they're comfortable, they can meet their own needs and have a little surplus as well. And you can see a little bit of what's happening there, that the crops, I think that's millet, growing right up to the tree trunk. And that sterile desert sand now getting enriched with the organic matter dropping from the trees. You can see over his left shoulder, firewood ready to sell this year. The trunk to his right, he'll probably harvest that in the next year. And then he's got a whole series of branches coming up that he's grooming for future years. And it's had a dramatic effect on crop yields and on animal production. And again, in relation to the theme of this conference, wise water use, some of the things that are happening under that tree there, this is a drought year. And you can see how much the crops away from the influence of the tree is really struggling. And so you've got that shading effect, reduced wind speeds, increased organic matter. And I think you can see the leaves that have acted as a mulch then, some of it would have already been incorporated into the soil, so it's humus holding more moisture that does fall. And then in addition to that, you've got an extra fertilizer effect. So during that 8-month dry season, and there's no fences in most of Niger, livestock are wandering freely. And where are they going to head for? Going to head for the shade. They're going to look for the seed pods to eat and for leaves and for the shade. And so all that manure is getting concentrated mostly around the base of the trees. And then the livestock themselves benefiting from that bit of extra browse that just simply wasn't there previously. And you can see the impact on crop yields. That research was done by Agricultural Research Institute of Senegal. And it's a more than doubling of crop yield with the influence of the trees. And so this is one of the farmer's greatest fears. Mr. Tony, if I leave these trees in my field, will I still get food? And it was very, very difficult to convince people initially. I think we had 10 or 12 early adopters. They're either very, very foolish for believing me or they had great insight into what was happening here. And the opposite to what people expected happened. Instead of reducing crop yields, the best yields come from amongst the trees. And then the whole swath of other benefits that come with the restoration of the environment. That mat there in northern Ghana, it's probably 4 metres of mat. Each little clump of green that you can see represents a different species that's regenerated on that land. And there's edible fruits, there's traditional medicines, dyes, bark that they use for rope, all these different things that they denied themselves as they destroyed the forest, now coming back. And the children having a great time. As soon as they're out from school, a lot of them are up in the trees, stuffing their faces. And I heard some of them some of the fruits had been very rare, but they had a special place in traditional cuisine. And the children find these rare fruits and sell them on the market. They're buying their textbooks with the money. It's obvious now looking back, but we never foresaw some of the other benefits. So, of course, as the trees came back, they created habitat and wildlife and beneficial insects and birds started to return. The cattle egrets in the acacia albida tree there, they're free fertilizer factories, and they start work at sunrise, going out through the fields, eating locusts, caterpillars, anything that moves that's smaller than them, and leaving fertilizer in their wake. Spiders started to come back, praying mantises, lizards, all these things that had nowhere to hide and nowhere to prey on their to seek out their prey from, now they started to return to the field. So there was a greater balance in the ecosystem. And one of the greatest things that's come out of it is it's not Tony's project or World Vision's project or the organisation I was with back then. It's the people's project. And they're the greatest promoters. Today, more than 5 million hectares in Niger is being managed under farmer-managed natural regeneration. And to be honest, we don't really know how that happened. We know we played a role. We know we told people. We brought in other groups, other NGOs, government people, farmers groups. We trained them for a day and sent them out. I sent my own farmers across the country. But we don't know how 5 million hectares were revegetated, except to say farmers talk to farmers over the farm gate. This guy here in Senegal, he's put up this 6-metre pole with a red flag on the top. And there's a main road that goes past his place, so everybody's curious, and they drop in to say, "What's this about?" And he tells them the whole story and says, you too should be doing this. So it's just spread organically from farmer to farmer. And my previous team leader in World Vision used to boast to me, he said, "Tony's the only team member in my team whose work can be seen from outer space." But normally when you see satellite images of the Sahel, you expect the years there to be the opposite. That's 2003 and all the dots are trees. That's 1975, and you'd expect the reverse to be true. But through the spread of this this movement, people are starting to adopt the regreening. Another surprise is we really didn't have much government backing. Locally, some of the foresters were working with us. They were very enthusiastic and they give price to the better farmers. But nationally, the people who we really tried to engage in this and create favourable policies that would spread it even further just weren't listening. Chris Razor is a researcher from Holland. And this is a statement that he made. This is probably the largest positive environmental transformation in the Sahel and perhaps in all of Africa. Chris has been researching land use change in Africa for over 30 years, so he's very well placed to make a statement like that. And the impact has just been simply enormous. Over the past 10 years, the utilisation of FMR Niger has resulted in sequestration of 100 to 200 million tonnes of carbon dioxide. They did local evaluation of the project in the district that I lived in, and I was very disappointed in the definition that they used for natural regeneration and the baseline. But even with a faulty definition, they still came up with this figure that the farmers were directly earning from the trees and from the benefit of the trees $17 to $23 million per year. To put it into context, Niger is often ranked as the poorest country in the world on the UN standard of living scale. And so as this movement started to grow in Niger, I started to think, well, where else would it be possible? And if you simply look at the vegetation map for Africa, you can see the vegetation type that goes through Niger. It spreads through the whole Sahel and down the eastern side. But Niger has one of the harsher climates, and you think, well, perhaps vegetation in wetter areas would do even better. And as I've had the opportunity to travel to Indonesia, to Burma, to other parts of Africa, I found that that's been the case. Often the soils are richer, the rainfall is higher, and the species have much greater capacity to regrow very, very rapidly. I got my first big break within World Vision in 2004. We started working in an area of southern Ethiopia, and I'd actually been talking to the farmers since 1999. Sometimes things take a long time to hatch, but I think what gave this project a little bit of profile was that it was World Vision's first carbon trading reforestation project, and for some reason having that label with it and the thought in people's minds, this is going to be a real cash cow, it'll bring money into the country, which is only partly true, but somehow that really lifted the profile. And also it was Ethiopia's first carbon trading project done in collaboration with the World Bank. And so the news started to spread, and particularly when they started to see the results that within 2 to 3 years, what had been a very barren, rocky hill, and you can see the red, maybe not, but the darker patches there, it's just bare ground. Much of the topsoil had been eroded. In the 1970s, this was a forest, but through poverty and neglect, much of the forest was destroyed. This is an area that experiences regular famine. And so people, not because they want to destroy the environment, but just out of sheer willpower to stay alive, they cut the forest, turned it into charcoal, and bought food for their families. But within a very short period of time after, we'd organised the communities into cooperatives, set ground rules that everybody abided by, got legal user rights from the government authorities. This was one of the big gaps before. Nobody owned the trees, so why should anybody look after them? But for this particular project, we're able to secure user rights. And then things started to happen, and you can see on the lower right there that what had been a barren hill, now all these trees have come back. Wildlife is starting to come back. An old man had tears in his eyes. He was telling me, I haven't seen some of these wild fruits for 40 years, since I was a child. There's less flooding, less erosion, more fodder. They actually told me, Mr. Tony, we're too much happy. Now we've got fodder in our backyard and firewood close by. We used to walk for miles to get it. We're too much happy. The thought that came to me was, well, I'm too much happy too, but I would have been too much more happy if you'd done this in 1999 when I first started talking about it. But as a result of that project, and it's barely into its fourth year, the government of Ethiopia has made a commitment to reforest 15 million hectares. This project is under 3,000. 15 million hectares, with or without carbon, which really made me happy because the whole process of securing carbon credits is very cumbersome and expensive in its current form. So with or without carbon, we want it. And the northern region of Ethiopia, Tigray, which is one of the most degraded parts of Ethiopia, it's the first government that I'm aware of anywhere in the world where they've institutionalized FMNR, meaning that every year it's part and parcel of the planning and activity of the Department of Agriculture, and they're rolling it out there on thousands of hectares. As I mentioned, I'm really privileged now in my current role. I get to travel much more widely, and so in the past year I've been to East Sumba in Indonesia, and what should be a tropical paradise, you can just see these very thin ribbons, these dark ribbons in the gullies. That's the remnant forest of East Sumba. And centuries of exploitation, overcutting, overharvesting of the sandalwood, burning, some warfare, centuries of that kind of treatment, and it's almost a desert. And you go to places like this, and the governor of that part of the island is shaking his head, and he said, God's forsaken us. This must be the worst place in the world to live. If we continue like this, we'll have to leave our island. And I'm shaking my head thinking, you don't know you're alive. There's worse places than this. But as we drove around, and you get out of the car, it's really important to get out of the car. You can't do this work in the car. And you brush away that coarse imparata grass, and you look, get down on your hands and knees and look under the grass. The trees are there. Even on this godforsaken island, in the words of that governor, the trees are there. They just need a chance. Look a little bit closer, they're there, but what's happening? Every year they burn this island from one end to the other. People don't have ownership of the trees. It's not mine, belongs to the king. Why should I care? I'm sure that people see those trees. It's not that I'm particularly intelligent or they're particularly silly. They know they're there, but there's no incentive, no motivation for them to change the practices that they have. Trees everywhere. And the more you go, the more you see. This is that part of Ethiopia, Tigray, the most degraded part of Ethiopia. There's a community there. The government was threatening to relocate them. Famine year after year. We can't leave you here. It's costing us too much feeding you every year. We'll take you to a better area. And they got really upset with that. Ethiopian history goes back centuries. They didn't want to move. There's 700-year-old churches there. Their ancestors were buried there. Why should we have to move? And in every community, I'm sure, every community has a champion. You just need to discover that person. As much as FMNR is about the technique, it's much, much more about the people. This guy's nickname, I don't know his real name, his nickname is Abahawi. Abahawi means fireman. And he's got one of those gravelly voices that you can't ignore. He said, we're not leaving here. Get off your butts. Let's do something. And they started digging water catchments around the hills. They plugged the gullies, turned them into dams. And they started creating these enclosure areas. And you can see the natural regeneration coming up there. The local acacia trees coming back. Within just a few years, the water table in the valley started to rise to within 2 to 3 meters of the surface. People that had been entirely dependent on the rains for their annual crop were now growing 2 to 3 cash crops per year during the dry season. All of them had little motor pumps. Incredible. Nobody had to leave home. A lot of people ask me when I go to different countries, they ask me, well, what do you do if there's no tree stumps to start with? And I love that statement that Brad made before, and I might not have caught it properly. Plant the rain and the plants will plant themselves. Beautiful. This landscape's about as close to Mars as you can get without going there, I think. It was so destroyed. It's in northern Niger. And they had an IFAD project, International Fund for Agricultural Development, and they started digging Zai pits and half moons to trap the water that did fall. But what happened over the years that followed was a forest appeared on its own. And a bit of a mystery, but not too much. I think in the animal droppings, perhaps the bird droppings, the tree seeds came in. Plant the rain and the plants will plant themselves. As much as I'm in the business of promoting regreening and it's all about trees and that, I've really come to appreciate and to realize over the last few years, it's about sowing joy. And I have these most incredible reactions when I run a workshop. People break into dance, they start clapping, they make up songs. It's really, really fun. And they get excited. And I think you come into a situation where you've got a trodden down people, beaten down, and hear all this scare talk about climate change. I don't want to diminish the seriousness of it, but people are really worried. And the conditions are worsening. Greater severity of storms, greater droughts, stronger winds blowing the roofs off, no fodder, decreasing crop yields. They're really scared. And then you tell them, you know, these insignificant tree stumps here, these little sprouts that you cut and burn every year and you plow under, actually they could make a big difference. And it's fun. And when I go back, I get to revisit sometimes after 1 year, after 2 years. Often they throw a party and they share with me all the things that are happening. Just to put it in a little bit broader context, I work within a team in World Vision Australia, so the food, climate change, energy and natural resources team. And so we're looking to introduce more sustainable approaches to agriculture. We're looking to access climate change funding, so whether that's in the form of biodiversity credits or carbon credits or whatever, trying to make that money accessible to the very poorest people of the world so that they can create a more sustainable landscape. We have energy experts, so looking at solar lighting, fuel efficient stoves, wind power, hydropower, and then in my section is natural resources. And over the last 3 years, because of the increasing awareness of natural regeneration and the benefits that it brings, probably 80% of my time now is spent just promoting this. I'm like in tree heaven, it's just great. And another aspect of my work, and I won't dwell on it because that's not the main theme, but I wanted to share it with you in case somebody wanted to take it up with me over the coming week, is using biodiversity to help people. These trees are Australian acacias, mostly from very, very arid areas in the outback. And on the left, Acacia tumida, and on the right, Acacia elacantha, growing in very low rainfall regimes and producing a heavy crop of what's essentially a bean crop. High protein, 25%, 40% carbohydrate, 6% fats, drought tolerant. Just fantastic at the very time when people are facing so much uncertainty with climate change. For rice, and I think it's very similar for the other major crops, every 1 degree increase in temperature translates into a 10% decrease in yield. Now, in some countries that are already on the edge and they're not growing enough food, and in parts of Africa where they're predicting 5 degree increase, that's a 50% drop in yield. And here's these trees, they're just smiling. 50 degrees Celsius, and in some cases even greater, thriving under those conditions. So it's a great untapped source. And it's not something that you're going to eat because you're starving and you have to. It actually tastes really, really good. And I was very pleased on the way over in the plane, they served wattle seed biscuits, acacia seed biscuits. Bit of a gimmick because there's not much acacia in there, but it was a sort of a reminder that, yes, you've got to keep pursuing this until this strategy is adopted also. But I won't dwell on that. If anybody's more interested, please see me later. And so this is Tony's grand scheme for world domination. Just as the interest and the awareness has been growing, I thought, well, I've got to get organized here. And my strategy is very simple. Once people are aware of what's happening and the potential, if they invite me for a workshop, we go and work with the community, and ideally bring in the media. There's nothing to hide. Bring in government officials. Bring in other NGOs. This isn't an exclusive club. It's for sharing. There's no patent on it. It's free. And the more people that hear about it, the better. And actually, when you think about it, natural resource management, you can't do it as an island. It requires all the stakeholders to be involved. So bring them all in. And I'm planning, I'm hoping, that over the coming years, I can run workshops in these different regions and just replicate the natural spread that we witnessed in Niger Republic. Why not see it in other places as well? So what's needed? Obviously awareness. As obvious as it is when you realise these things are at your feet, a lot of people just don't see it. So first step is awareness creation, provision of training, because a few simple requirements. You use sharp implements, the way you prune, when you prune, which species. So a few guidelines, not rules, not hard, fast rules, but a few guidelines that people need to know about. Fire prevention, it wasn't really a great issue in Niger, but now as I've travelled more widely, Burma, Indonesia, I've realised it's one of the major reasons for continued state of deforestation. The forest would come back on its own if we'd only stop burning it. And then create an enabling environment. Give people the freedom to utilise the trees that are in their area. So many governments try to protect the forest by keeping the people out. For a start, it's impossible anywhere. I've never seen a place where governments have been able to effectively keep poor people out of the forest. We've all got this will to survive. For goodness sakes, give them the freedom. Give them the user rights. If not outright ownership, give them the user rights. But along with that, teach them how to manage that resource sustainably. And I like to stir people up. I often, in a workshop, I'll address the foresters and say to them, if you want to keep this forest, you have to learn to give it away. And then I say to the community, if you want to use this forest, you have to learn how to use it sustainably. As I mentioned earlier, marketing seems to be a really critical part in the success of the story. People have to be able to make a living off the natural resources around them. Very important to have all the stakeholders that are involved reading from the same page. So we'll have lots of meetings with the communities. What are the rules and regulations that you want to make so that we can improve this environment? And then always try to work with the existing structures, whether there's a traditional structure or a farmers development group or a cooperative. Work through the existing structures. Much, much easier than trying to create new ones.
This program and all previous episodes are available to download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you'd like to give feedback on this episode, you can do so at unwelcomeguests.net/633. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this episode has helped you put the mental back into environmental and be that much more suspicious of large schemes for saving the environment, which have been worked out on an abstract level. That much more in favour of grassroots, individual, bottom-up change to get outside the box of the institutions, the ideas, the frameworks that tie us into a world of competition and not one, like the natural world, of glorious cooperation.